Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. It is Wednesday afternoon. It's 3 days on from Ireland's 18-13 World Cup quarterfinal defeat to France. And we've decided to reopen some of Sunday's wounds. Hannah O'Connor and Lindsay Pete have joined me on the podcast couches. Thanks a million for joining us, folks. Where do we start? How are you feeling 3 days on, Lindsay?
I feel like this is a group therapy session. Yeah,
let it all out.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So if I start blubbering,
we're all friends here.
I have tissues for you too, Hannah. Oh, just in case.
This all stays in the sanctity of the podcast studio and YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm here to be vulnerable. I am absolutely. I'm heartbroken, and I would think, I'm sure Hannah will speak of our own personal experiences, but we've been there, you know, and we haven't done it at a World Cup, and to. It's very conflicting, Neil, I'll be honest, because we've seen the trajectory. We've seen them rise from the dark days. It's like something I see now of Harry Potter. It's like the rebirth of the Phoenix. Like we've seen that, and I don't want that missed. But then you look back at the performance on Sunday and everything, you know, we would have spoken about looking for heart and fight and Irish spirit and for a country who has potential to rip up history books and rewrite it. That's this small, beautiful country of ours. And there's huge potential in this team. And the growth over 2 years has been phenomenal. But to put France under pressure and tactically get us the territory, which I'm sure we'll cover, the stats are absolutely ridiculous. And we're superior in so many of them. And we just didn't capitalise. Like, to get that many entries into the 22 and not even have a basic plan. We did look rudderless when we got into there. And then just the killer was obviously the yellow cards just for half time, and to waste 6 minutes of that going through, 34, 36 phases and just running into blue brick walls. And Mama Sue Fall Racklow was absolutely phenomenal. Like, she was a leader for the French team. But we made it handy for them. So work ethic and all of that, it just didn't translate. And then I suppose we all had that bad omen when we didn't come away with something from that last entry just before halftime, even if it was 3 points.
Anything. That was the worrying part as well. Yeah, it was just the disappointment of you're probably going to, that one will sting so much because you're probably not going to get a better crack at it at a quarterfinal ever again. Like that, when you come away with it, if you've been beaten out the gap, you could take it more. But knowing that that match was yours and you should have won it is probably the hardest thing to take. And everything that, as you said, the journey that the girls have been on, where it's come from, where it's got to, for it to kind of come undone there is just such a sickener. It'll just sting for so long for them. So yeah, just gutted for them, everything they've been through to fall like that.
And like Lindsay, obviously you mentioned the 35 phases just before halftime. I think when Hannah came on with us on the pod along with Alison Miller on Sunday, and that was pretty much the first place we jumped in on as well. It's hard to look back on that game and pick out a more defining moment in that match, even though there's 40 minutes still to play. Just the difference between an 18/20 point lead, depending on a conversion, and 13 points, just even at the time felt enormous.
Yeah, we talked about it, and it was kind of said at the start. Myself and Ali were talking. Ali Miller were saying, "How much of a lead do you need with the wind and the elements?" And I said, 15-20 at least." And then you're still talking when you get to that point of the game. To be able to, Lindsay, you mentioned it, like just to have the experience and not to, like France at that stage are player down. Gabby Vernier for me is your defensive leader for them, as well as Madusu Fall Racklow, who will make a mess of everything that you put around her. We seem to go back and forth in a zigzag pattern at times when if we just kept coming pods around the corner, suck Vernier in, take out their connectivity from it, they're down a player, the holes will come, just keep making them fold. I know the elements were what they were, but I think we just played into France's hands too much. When you don't come away, we've seen it so often in men's games, women's games, when you don't score before halftime, it just, France are going in buoyed, Ireland are coming in a bit zapped at halftime, and it just gives them life heading in with the wind advantage in the second. So it was killer.
And I noticed one thing, right? Now, I'm going to say this from someone who has done it, and because you mentally go in with a battle. But so on the turnover or whatever happened just before halftime, it was I can't remember who the offload was, right? But poor decision, that's fine. They were wrecked. But Pauline Bourdon-Sansus, the nearest person to her was Dana O'Brien. And she smirked sadistically and pat her on the head. Mm-hmm. Now, personally, I've done that because you're like, I've gotten.
I have definitely had that from you.
Hannah, this is not the time or the place. I know it is a counselling session, but we'll talk about that later. I'm sorry. I am a different beast. I hope I am. But anyway.
It was telling, though.
It's mentally, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to get into the psyche. And that is the part of elite sport that nobody actually covers enough of. Like, it is a war of attrition. And our girls were ready for war. And they brought the fight to France. And it is commendable. Like, honestly, I'm still getting goosebumps here. And I do well up because they gave every ounce themselves. They really did. But that was a defining moment for me because as much as I love her, I was like, damn it, she's actually getting into the head. And what I love was Dana fought back, but I was like, no. It's now they've got an injection of energy and positivity because of it. Does when you've put in a defensive effort like that, which was unbelievable by the French, which is probably, am I being unfair? Like, they can be hit and miss as to how hard absolutely they want to work, but yeah, by God, did they absolutely defend their line. And I watched and I listened to a couple of the interviews before, and they said, we want to play with French freedom, which they want to do. They couldn't in the conditions, but we want to match them on the other side of the ball, which is defensively. And I think they only conceded 15 points in the group stage. Now, mm-hmm, look, stats are stats, and albeit you have to look at who their opposition were. But that's, they set their stall out and they actioned what they wanted to say. Mm-hmm. But that for me was the defining moment of just what they got into our heads then. We were far superior up to that time, yep, but they just went in at half time. And the other bit is, and look, you can tell me, were we predictable? Let's be honest here.
I think in the first half we were, you could have said we were predictable, but we executed entries.
Predictable and probably the right ways.
Yes.
100% yeah, getting us into the 22. Yep. But how choices predictable, yes.
Good choices we had made up until that little phase of, not that little phase, that huge phases of the 35 phases together. Up until that point, picked line out, executed a well mold.
Yes.
Then the next time we came down, we went, no, penalty move, Linda scores, perfect. It was like making the right decisions, and then we'd obviously taken the three as well, good decision, made it. And it was the only time that the switch came that it was like, we're zigzagging back and forth here. And yes, as you said, come away with something. But just someone say, they're a player down. If we keep coming around the corner, they have to suck bodies in. They'd been giving away penalties up until that point. Just make them do it again, be another card. And then, but we just played into their hands too much. And then, as you said, just the offload decision. Yes, look, you look at it and it's not the greatest decision, but you're so fatigued at that stage. It just is one of those things that just swings it.
On that, and you mentioned like what they probably should have been doing is coming around the corner, rather than the zigzag approach is... Like, from what you've seen in previous games, are they doing that in other games? Was this probably a moment where maybe players kind of froze up just ever so slightly, yeah, with the tension of the game?
I don't know about you. I found in a few games that we've gone around that middle third, if Dana hadn't got the opportunity to kick, that we've kind of gone back blindside. And a lot of the times it's ended in a turnover for against us. And I felt that it wasn't the best move for the players that we have to kind of go to that kind of truck it up the jumper kind of rugby. It didn't suit us at times, and I don't know, was it a tactic or was it just someone not saying let's keep going here towards the post and eke something out here, because worst case scenario we get a penalty and it's an easier kick for Dana then to go for the post off left foot, right, you know, we're on the mm-hmm right side of the pitch. So I don't know, is it a tactic or is it just kind of something you fall into in the game? You know yourself, we've been in those sessions where you do training sessions specifically for green line scores. And we've all been there where we'll spend 10 minutes and the coaches pull you in and you look back at it on the review after and you're like, what the hell were we doing? Like, mm-hmm, everyone is in the same boat. So you have been there, you understand what it's like, and you can't quite put your finger on maybe what's the one thing that stops that from happening. So
it's hard, I suppose. If I'm to give an honest synopsis of it, we don't have that point guard that directs us. And Dana is phenomenal for mm-hmm what game plan we have. And we've seen that it's kick to territory, and our territory is 60%+ for the overall game. In the yeah first half, I think it was in the 80s, was it?
Yeah.
So from that point of view, again, tactically, we were brilliant. We came back, she was left foot. We went down as we looked down the pitch, left-hand channel, and her kicks were excellent. And our choices, I thought, were phenomenal. Yeah. So I was mm-hmm like, right, we're actually doing our homework here. You know, we're not going for lineouts, even though we're probably third highest return rate on it. Our tap penalties were excellent. Our scrum was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But then you look at it and you're like, right, for Stacey's try now, you can see Stacey chatting to Dana. So she's obviously saying, they're narrow, getting out. I'm assuming this is kind of the chat with her. And that's brilliant, because that's what you want maybe your 12 or your fullback coming into the line doing. But there wasn't enough of that.
Yeah.
Like, there's no autonomy to look at, right, well, what's the D giving us? Like, if you look at France's try in the second half, they obviously done their homework that Ireland overfold, which mm-hmm Canada did in the warm-up game as well, mm-hmm, overfold and swung back. And then they're going down an easy channel between our 9 and 10. And I'm kind of like, well, where's our homework done on top of that when we get in the 22 and we're trying to pull phases together because we're narrow. Our pods are too close. We've no one, even a front door runner to get out the back and no one's saying, okay, they're narrow, let's go out the back or keep plugging phases. And then when France sucked in, then you're kind of hitting them out back. Our wingers didn't come off their wings. Mm-hmm. Like, where's the play to get our wingers off? Yeah. Like, we've world-class wingers. We've world-class players. But our back three especially, for all they've been through between sevens, Olympics, and now over the last 2 years being integrated in 15s, like that just mind-boggled me. And then not emptying the bench was, I thought, guilt. Like, it, you have to be brave here. Our girls were brave. Our coaching staff maybe weren't as brave. I don't understand why Anna, like, you could play Anna back row, you could play her, she's fresh, like she's nearly 6 foot, like she's a much more physical player. She's played centre. Enya, not sure whether she's carrying an injury. Emily Lane to speed up the game.
So, and Emily Lane always plays
and always comes on at a time when teams are fatigued.
Going back to the WXV last year, like we've spoken about scrum half, the two of us, quite a bit, and how it's chopping and changing constantly between who's starting. But the only constant across those last 14, 15 games dating back to last year, Emily Lane's been in the matchday squad for every single one of them. And it's either Avian Riley or Molly Scuffle McCabe who's the other one chopping and changing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's clearly trust there. That week in, week out, he's going to be having her in the team.
But I was surprised that Sam came off when she did. Mm-hmm. For me, you know, you lose Tricky and you lose your one of your co-captains, obviously through injury or not getting picked for that week. I'd keep Sam on there. And not that I wouldn't back, but just for a voice of that calmness, that yes, Fiona's calling the lineouts, but, and not that it hinges on that, but just that calmness of clarity. It saves Amy Lee coming off the wing every time to be in the referee's ears on those decisions. I was surprised she came off when she did. Maybe it was more of a knock than it was. But yeah, then just not
she
to trust.
She looked wrecked to me now. Absolutely looked gassed.
Yeah, fair enough. And I suppose she's still coming back.
The back and injury-wise, sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't want to be harsh, so I suppose you played 10 more than me. you know, no, and people have a higher rugby IQ and it's a different position when you have that. And that's the one thing I think we just remiss, the subs. I do agree with Sam, if at all you could leave her on. But when I tell you, she just looked like everyone else. She gave everything and she was a little bit gassed. And then fatigue brings other decisions. So,
but even someone like Enya is a loud voice.
Yeah.
So it's like your centres are gassed. She's a loud voice and can give Dana confidence into like what's calling. She's almost like having the two tens on the pitch when you put her on, just for the voice from an attacking point of view. But I suppose it's all those shoulda, woulda, coulda. It's interesting. The last time we didn't use the bench as much was in the
WXV against Blackburn.
Well, yes, but also we didn't use it as much the last time when we actually qualified against Scotland up in Belfast. I felt that was a time when a lot of people were left on the bench that day too. So don't know, just a coaching decision, I suppose. Yeah. But you got to trust it. You would have liked to have seen trusted. Like, if you're going to do it, trust the players. You put them on the bench, trust them, and use them to freshen it. Maybe, yeah,
because it's ticking away. You're kind of like, right, we're in a losing position. So you're either you give everything at it and you try and win this game. Or, you know, you'd rather die trying and throwing everything, you know, I mean everything, an Irish jig, whatever you have to throw at the French.
Well, speaking of that, I don't know, Lindsay, have you seen, I was talking about Hannah, but the video Maeve Liston posted on Instagram
of
Ruth Campbell. For those who haven't seen it, look up Maeve Liston on Instagram. Just a fascinating bit of footage from the stands of the second last line out Ireland had. The one where the mall got very close towards the line and somehow hit the ground. But in the moments before that line out, the Irish players are standing in there ready to go. Ruth Campbell darts out of the line out about 3 or 4 yards and projectile vomits towards the touchline. By which stage the ball is thrown into the line-out, she turns around and just heads straight back in, head down and into the mall.
Yeah.
And Ireland get up to around 3 or 4 metres out. I was saying that if the Springboks had done that, the South African fans will be saying, Razzie Erasmus, what an innovator. Well, look at what he's doing.
He's making
Look at how far he's thinking ahead.
Yeah, and if actually from the Maeve's angle you can see one, but actually from the opposite angle, right, you can see Ruth kind of obviously her shoulders heave. So I'm like, oh my God, dear Jesus, she's after hold it and everything. And then her timing is impeccable to distract
the French.
But
it perfectly sums up like how those players absolutely
emptied it
out on the pitch. Quite literally emptied it. Although I would be interested to see if Ireland, for example, had scored a try off the back of that,
Would a TMO
have been questioned? Well, Sechenor leaves the line out before the ball is thrown.
Yes, for a dummy.
Imagine if Ireland lost off the back of that.
I know.
Anyway.
Don't even bring up controversy because I'm sure we're going to cover a lot of it.
We'll get to it. Before we do, I do want to talk about the scrums because we mentioned how dominant Ireland were in the scrum. And a couple of bits about it. The first point I want to make, it's just kind of like sometimes rugby has these silly loopholes in laws. And for that 35 phase attack just before halftime, like Ireland are dominant. They have a penalty down 5 metres from the French line. They have a dominant scrum. So they we're going to take a scrum is what they choose. France don't take the hit. So it's a free kick. And obviously nowadays you can't opt for another scrum off the back of a free kick.
But you also
can't kick for the touchline anymore because it's going to be a French ball. It's going to be a French throw. So all of a sudden, Ireland, just by having a dominant scrum, have ended up in a situation where they only have one option and that's a pick and go. And it's not a criticism of the referee because that is the law.
You'd flip it the other way, though. That's probably the cuteness.
This is the cuteness of the French.
And you can bet that Pauline Bourdon is saying something. Pauline Bourdon Sansouz has probably got something to do with it because you said she's in everything. She makes them tick, even though it's a front row decision. You can bet that there was something said there. But that's what we talk about, probably that little bit of naivety in our girls, not like in terms of ages and caps and everything and being there on that scene. That probably, yeah, like France have done one there to get the best outcome for them out of it after being dominated.
But I'd say that's a preempt plan. More than Razzie when you can take a scrum off the touch now. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I would say this is something that Mignon and David Ortiz, like definitely Mignon would have been that general and like she was a cute hooker. Like anything, if she could crawl under your leg, she would. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I'm not surprised and I would think this is something they preempted for any team, not just Ireland. I'm sure we could see it on Saturday in the semi-final because they're going to need every single bit
of it. Yeah.
And also it's like it's timing when you actually pull that one out of the bag because you can't do it a second time it is going to be a penalty again. So if you're going to do it as well as that.
Yeah.
But to move on from the scrum then, like Ireland's scrum was brilliant on Sunday, but I just want to bring up early stages of the second half and it's the point where France actually pick off their first 3 points of the game. So scrum's a big weapon. It's actually from the penalty that Aoife Wafer won from the biting instant, which we'll get to a little bit later. But Ireland win a penalty in their own half. They go for a scrum. They win a penalty at that scrum and they choose to scrum down again. They win another penalty advantage, go through some phases, and ultimately it's Aoife Wafer gives away a penalty for taking a French player out off the ball.
Yeah.
But I just want to bring it back to like, is that a little bit... I know obviously the plan there is you want to tire out the French, you want to potentially try milk a yellow card if your scrum is completely dominant. Is it a little bit naive to be trying to do that inside your own half though?
So I'd probably take another scrum to plant the seed in the referee's head that, you know, we're far superior here because with scrum times, it's about painting pictures and putting the idea in the referee's head. So we had done a good job with that. But to take the second scrum, I probably wouldn't have. I would have tried to gain a lot of more territory then and get us out of our half. I'm very surprised they didn't do that because really the rule in our half, we don't like to play. We just want to kick. So we kind of deviated from the plan that we're like, okay, we want you to do something different, but actually at this stage, please do what you normally do.
Yeah.
Get the ball out of there. I thought it was very harsh and it was one of the turning points. I think it was 47 minutes on the clock. We had just started halftime and that's when that 3 points. And again,
it would have been 47 by the time it would have happened because you'd three scrums gone. I think it was 41 or two by the time when the first penalty arrived.
And again, it's these moments. So they go in after patting Dan on the head. They're after going through the phases. They have that energy going into halftime and they've reached charge themselves and they're coming back out and it's that first 10 minutes of halftime that is your most important both tactically on your decision making and just literally taking care of the ball and not getting P-lines. Now I really whether you call me biased or not, that's a really harsh penalty because when you've made a decision, if me and Hannah or you're Carrie and Neil and we're deciding we're clearing the rough for you make a decision to clear a French jersey early. You don't know whether they're going in for that ball or not. So
she's probably like on the other side, she's probably like and it's because it's probably Wafer and the scrum hat sticks out and she comes in out with such gusto. If someone else came in as a bit more casual, they probably would have got away with it. I think she's like nearly that, like not even half a metre of distance away from being in the ruck that the referee decides to bring her. But likewise, you see them go the opposite way. Yeah. It's because she comes in to absolutely kill her. that probably like sees the difference of the ref going not ping, but harsh. It is a bit harsh to give it that way. But it's those little swings, as you said, those 10 minutes on either side of half time, learning to manage a game. And the girls will learn so much from this. They are your ones to mind in any level of the game. They're your golden 10 minutes to either solidify what you've done and lock them out for that next 10 minutes. And then they get their in and they take their in, as the French do. And that shows their kind of cuteness to it as well, I suppose, and their experience paying off.
There's nowhere with kickable penalties really against teams like that.
Especially with her.
Yeah.
Bourgeois.
And with the wind behind France at that stage backside, as well.
Yeah.
We've gone long enough without talking about the bite. So I think it's time to talk about it. The details to before we get into it. So Axel Berthomew has been given a 9-week ban now for a bite on Aoife Wafer in around the 42nd minute on Sunday. It started out as an 18-game ban reduced to 12. That's since been cut to 9, though, on appeal due to a procedural error. She was technically entitled to the full 50% mitigation to bring it back down to 9 weeks. So Berthomew apologised to Wafer on social media on Monday. She said, "I lost my temper Sunday against Ireland. I know this is not acceptable and I am aware this puts an end to my World Cup. I'd like to apologise to Aoife Wafer and Team Ireland, my teammates and staff and all those who support us. It's not the image I want to give nor the player I want to be. I accept the sanction. Rugby is a respect sport and the gesture has nothing to do on a rugby field." There's a couple of interesting bits around the details of the suspension and just the wording of how it was all kind of communicated by World Rugby. So in the first announcement of the suspension, the judgment says, "In reviewing the matter live, the TMO was unable to determine clear and obvious foul play and did not have the benefit of additional evidential submissions to corroborate." Since then, the tournament's competition director, Yvonne Nolan, said, "Correct process was followed by officials." She said, "These type of incidents are notoriously difficult to deal with in-game. I recognise people will review screenshots and so on, and they will have their own views, but I would caution that these incidents are really rare. I don't think I've ever seen a biting incident being dealt with in-game. They almost always require additional information after the match. That usually includes interviews with players, ruling out things like accidental contact, and they need to establish the force and the contact. So a detailed statement from the player is typically needed. I would just say a word of caution of jumping to a conclusion and removing a player unless the evidence is really categoric in-game is really challenging, and that is what the citing process is for. It's there to deal with issues like this, and the right process has been gone through." What jumps out to me on that, Hannah, is like the tournament director has effectively come out and said it's next to impossible to red card a player for a biting game unless the referee has clearly seen it happen.
For me on this one, there's two things. Okay, you take for... there obviously wasn't the same angle of camera in that TMO's hut that we saw on the screenshots going around like wildfire about 5 minutes after it happened. So that's kind of what you're reading from that. But also, never, ever, ever in a game, no matter how much you hated someone or were trying to get the up, would you ever throw out that someone has bit you if it's not true? So surely I think there has to be something at that point that if someone says someone has bit me, as Aoife did, as Sam did, you have to stop it and have a look. No more than they do for, say, racial abuse. I know that's different extremes for like in the soccer. They kind of stop things and have a real investigation into it. And I'm not saying they're two the same at all, but at the same time, it's so serious. And it's not it's such a big thing that you surely have to do something in game at that moment to stop. Go and ask the player that she's accusing early and see, does she say, you know, did I do it? And if not,
does she blush? Does she blush?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, if she has a bite mark on her arm, even with the... I just think when you look back at the footage, fine if they didn't see it, but I just think it's crazy to think that you can make an apology to that extent and then still get it reduced. Despite, like, you... so you've apologised, I'm really sorry, but I'm going to appeal it. Like... you can't appeal it.
What was the mitigation? She didn't get a good chunk out of the wafer. Like, I don't understand.
You know, apologise, good conduct at the hearing, all these sorts of things.
You could have good conduct, but sorry, if you bite someone.
I have always been fascinated. You see it in all of these suspensions and the written rulings. What is like good conduct during the process? It's just like...
you sit there.
It's not me anyway. It's not... She laughed. I knew. I was like, I'm getting in here before she does.
You haven't got a red card though in international games.
In any game, excuse
yeah, sorry,
you.
In any game.
How rude.
And I did.
But the good conduct during the process.
Against the Japanese. Oh, yeah, yes, we won't go there. It's not about me, though.
The
carry
good
on.
Conduct during the process line is like during the citing process. Like, essentially, the player
showed
up and wasn't rude to everyone.
That's the same.
But to bring that up, as you said, she went back twice to to have a little nibble. That's where some of the quotes here of the TMO was unable to determine clear and obvious foul play. I would have sympathy with the referee in that situation where, you know, obviously you can't just keep going to a TMO if someone says something happened. But if a player says something happened and there's something very suspicious on a replay, I would absolutely be putting the responsibility on the TMO to say, okay, hang on, there's been an accusation from a player out on the pitch. I've seen something that looks very suspicious here. There's a player holding her arm up saying, look, I've been bitten.
Yeah, you can clearly look it.
I can absolutely cut the referee a bit of slack there, but I just think
I can
from
only
a TMO's perspective,
that
needs to be so much better.
Yeah, but come here, he was able to see the... fair play to his eyesight because I couldn't see the knock on that chalked off Sam's try, so he could see the knock on before that, but you couldn't see the double chunk for the bite. Now look, I agree with you, right? Amy Theron has enough to be dealing with if you're the referee, right? There's enough, and obviously now with World Rugby and the way they want to play the game, no more than the men's, is they want to keep it flowing because it's a spectacle, and it was the best quarter final of the weekend by far as a spectacle. Okay, but surely, if memory serves me right, Sam did ask her and she asked twice. And I know she said, we have our process. You have your process. We have ours. Leave us to do ours. So you would assume then, look, there was a lot going on there. Ian, would you check there? TMO, would you check there for me and see, is there any, do we need to stop the game? I'll leave it with you and come back to me if there's anything. Surely we can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I agree with you too. You've got to keep it flowing to say that. And she says, I think the statement would have been better if they just come out and said the footage we had at the time didn't show that. You would have been better saying we didn't actually have the angle that everybody else had in our angles, that feedback. That would make more sense, not what's been... I just, as you said, I missed you the first time. Oh, wait, no, there's your arm again. I'll bite you now again. And like, it wasn't like...
Thank God for the gum shield.
I wonder if that set off the red light flashing. If you
I want to
somebody.
Know how well Aoife Wafer tasted. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, she went
it's
back
sign
twice.
Sign of how irritating she is to play against. So it's a compliment to her that she annoys
indirect
you that much.
Indirect compliment, I bit you.
But then, like, the 18 weeks reduced to 12. Now it's down to 9. I think we were saying it a little bit earlier on, myself and Hannah. 9 does feel a bit lenient.
And I assume then if she misses...
Single digits... feels lenient.
We're not going to miss any games, really.
She'll just
club
have
wise.
Her club, but she'll be back for six. Or she'll be back for she'll be back for the start of Six Nations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but 9 weeks if she starts now because
before that March 1st or whatever it is, or before that.
Because there's two games already. If they were knocked out, I assume it waits until the club season starts, and she misses her 9 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure she's going to miss too many.
I just think
it starts now in the semi final.
Yeah, I just think as you said, like, where's your good conduct? Okay, fine, you've apologised. You can't go and say sorry and then appeal it.
Yeah.
You can't be that sorry. Like, if
I'm
you had
sorry,
done that,
I'm sorry, but
I'm not that sorry for 12 weeks.
I'm
give
not 12
nine.
Weeks sorry.
No,
I'm
like,
9 weeks sorry.
Now.
Here's your piece of your arm back.
Yeah, I just think you got to take your punishment if you do the deed in
right.
that case.
Let's put a bow on that and we'll put it away and we'll talk about it again another time. Where next for this Irish team? Because there's a... There's a big 4 years coming up before a World Cup in Australia. And I think if you look at the age profile of this Irish team, there's a big case to be said that the next World Cup is the real World Cup from their point of view of when they're all going to be hitting their peak. And there'll probably even be a handful of players in that squad that we don't even know anything about at this stage. Mm. But you have a World Cup in 4 years' time. You have a Six Nations, standalone Six Nations game at the Aviva Stadium next season against Scotland, which is, in fairness, it's a bold call to strike while the iron's hot next year and do it. You know, it would have been understandable, I'd say, if they kind of said, maybe we'll wait another year when we've got England or France at home and it's a bigger game in theory, but they're backing it. Scotland, that's actually going to be a really interesting game as well, because Scotland have been a team on the up in the last year or two as well. That could potentially be a second or a third, you know, third place decider in the Six Nations. You've Alex Codling moving on to his job at Munster. Scott Beaman's contract will be up at the end of the Six Nations as well. So, he has indicated he wants to have another crack at a World Cup. So obviously there'll be a decision to be made there. There's a lot of stuff going on over the next couple of years.
There is. And I suppose that's the goal now.
A lot of exciting stuff.
Yeah, a lot of exciting stuff. I think let's take the fixture in the Aviva. That is going to be unbelievable. And if there's anyone listening, spread the word. Get it as Christmas presents. The tickets, there's a flash sale to the end of the week. Get your tickets. Get them as Christmas presents. I've bought them because I know I've told the story of...
You've ruined the surprise for all your friends now.
Why?
The Christmas surprise.
Oh yeah, no, I don't, Hannah, I haven't got yours yet. I'll get it. I'll get you too.
I'll cool my ears.
But No, because when I drive over Northside, Southside, my son has asked who plays in the Aviva, and I've had to tell him, and I'll tell him the good news now that the girls will be playing now after Christmas, and that, like, because he was having an absolute hissy fit as to why the men only played there, you know. But I think this is a sign of where the growth of this, it's huge, the women's game here. Mm-hmm. And on the back of, I was over in Brighton, there was so many people. Honestly, you could have been in Ballsbridge or you could have been in Jones's Road. There was so many Irish there. It was an absolute cracker of a weekend. And just the atmosphere and everyone coming in and in mingling, and the bananas come up to me and they're from Nace Rugby. It was just absolutely brilliant. And if we can bring that to the Aviva, it's just going to be a new mark in the history and the trajectory of this team. But that's the growth and the support side of things. Technically, we need to get someone as good as Alex Codling in.
Yeah, 100%.
If Scott is going to stay, he needs to now cement his defensive and his attack coach. And I think now it's the technical side of this team. We've done the growth. We've done the exposure to international rugby. This
You have Lynn Cantwell, who is taking care of the longer term stuff and the grassroots.
Yeah. And we need clubs and her to really ride the crest of this wave to get an influx of players. We have obviously Niamh Briggs, and that cohort coach is looking after the under-20s, and there's some Grace Davitt is involved with them as well, and there's a huge amount of very talented players there, so we need to get them integrated very early. And you know, there's so much talk around the Celtic Challenge, but they really probably, ideally for me personally, I'd like to our under-20s to play in them rather than our international.
Agreed.
But then if you're going to do that, the internationals need to come back to our club game.
Agreed.
And we need to get a better standard. Like, great, we've the Six Nations game, but we need then next summer to have a tour, as much international exposure to especially Southern Hemisphere teams. You know, I'm not sure about finances, but ideally over the next 3 years, we need to get games down under to see about timing, climatize, time difference, all of that, altitude, everything that could come at us in Australia in 4 years' time, we need to be now navigating that and be preparing. Mm-hmm. So this is where we need to see this.
Lions in New Zealand in 2 years' time as well.
It's all exciting. It's all showing where the women's game has come. Like, if you think back, like, even 5 years ago, where like it's been so talked about where we were as a team, but to see all these things and all the exciting things to be looking forward to, of like how to build on this now and where we've come to, is just so exciting and so refreshing to be talking about that now and be able to watch it with that viewpoint on it. But as Lindsay said, it's putting all the correct pieces in place, and I've spoken about it so much from having been in there, and Lindsay, you'd be the same, of like putting the right people in there. It's what they do next to put the right bodies in there to make sure that a replacement is found that is suited and fit for the job, so that the 4 years as they build upon to the next World Cup is done in the best possible way imaginable.
Because we're grand for I suppose the second tiers outside of the New Zealand's, Canada's, England's, and like Scott has said about bridging that gap. Now we need to action bridge in that gap. It's not within our, outside of our reach after the performance on Sunday. The weather played a huge part in taking away the French's jouet and standard playing and moving the ball. But I think we've the athletes, and we're not a big nation. We're very like our men. We have to adapt to what's our strengths, and we can play that offloading game. Even on yourself is the most horrific attack to play against when you're defending, when that ball keeps moving,
turning around, running
backwards. Your absolutely lungs are on fire, they're hanging out your backside, you're like, please someone kill the ball, because it's, you're just constantly moving, and the level of fitness you have to play that on both sides of the ball. But it's easier to play attack when you're moving and you have a smile on your face and you're just absolutely tearing the defence apart. But
I think that's what we're going to take away from it the most, though, is, as you said, like getting those match minutes, but that kind of decision making, and it's on everybody. Obviously we talk about Dana, your tens, your decision makers, your nines, but like everybody's having been there and been in those moments, what would you do differently? Like, if you had your time back again, what would you do? And it's only from playing in those minutes and playing in those big occasions. Like, you can never replicate having a line out in the like 81st minute. You can never do that training. You can put all the sound effects on and you can make it seem like, but it's never the same. But now they've lived it. Yes, it hasn't gone the way they wanted to, but those are going to count to them. And the more minutes they get against, as you said, it's about chasing the tier ones, and not like, we've probably, in what we've done, pushed well away from the likes of the Italy's and so on over the last couple of years, and showing what we can do against them. But now it's about chasing the others and keeping chasing and not settling for where we are. Because the next time we go to a World Cup, quarterfinals where we've been, we've got to push the barrier even further. And the sky's the limit, I think, for the group. As you said, the age profile, the style of play, the talent of players that we had, hopefully it'll keep coming through.
I mean, like the Venn diagram of expanding the attacking game and the age profile of this team, like, Dan O'Brien, I think, turns 22 next week. Like, and she has a pretty solid bank of rugby behind her back already over the last three seasons. And if you're talking 25 going on 26 in a World Cup in 4 years' time. There's a lot of time, a lot more experience to get into her in terms of running that attack and running a week, as players would often say.
Yeah, and look, the team obviously celebrated my retirement by going to Japan. That was very nice of them. I missed that. Anna was there. Look at her. She's laughing.
She took a moment to be got there.
Gone. Let's go to Japan. But that was the first exposure of Dana O'Brien there. And obviously Anna will be able to speak about this more.
And Aoife Dalton as well, and a couple others.
Do you know what? I love that child. Never met her in my life. I've heard great things about her personality, but she's just a little pocket rocket. And I hope she gets involved in one of the team, the tournaments or something, because she was always able to get K9. The thing about it is, it's a bit like your centre half, your holding midfielder, your point guard. Like, with age, Dana will only get better. She'll be like a fine wine. I'm showing my age now. But, like, I'd love to see her probably go to either all our internationals are back around our AIL and we make it as strong as we can.
Yep.
If that's not the option, she needs to go to England. Mm-hmm. Why does she need to go to England? Because we need her playing under pressure. Mm-hmm. We need her to make decisions when her kicking game and territory game is taken away from her. We need her involved with the likes of Mo Hunt. If I was in Gloucester, I'd be holding hands with Mo Hunt and asking her every tactical question I could, because she is brilliant at it. Mm-hmm. That's what her job is. Or Holly Aitchison, or any of the Canadian... Alex Tessier was unbelievable as that secondary 10.
Pulling the strings, isn't it?
Oh, like, she's fantastic in her IQ. She's an ex-basketball player. Mm-hmm. So we need her involved and asking questions. And I don't want to take away from the league. We had to either work from the top down or the bottom up. We can't fix everything all at once. But that would be my options for Dana. And there's huge potential in this player. Like, she's come back time and time again, and the pressure on her shoulders and the questions being asked of her, she hasn't shied away from it, and she's only going to get better. And I'm excited to see that.
Yeah.
But we need to help her. We need to facilitate that. How is Scott going to facilitate that growth for not only Dana, this whole team, to improve those decisions they make collectively, individually. And that's going to be his toughest job. And that's where he needs to look at where he's placing his players, who he's going to get in as his coaching staff, and what test games he's going to get in over the next 4 years. And that's a tough, tough job.
Yeah, because you see what you can do in the space of time, like taking those two, Aoife Dalton and Dana O'Brien, for two examples. Mm-hmm. From, as I said, they started off making their debuts totally unfazed in Japan at that stage. And like, we used to sit down on the bus, I've said this before, like, and we used to turn around and pepper her with questions because she was the one. We knew that she was the starting 10.
The moon tore her.
Yeah, we're
glass.
Like, so we have a penalty here and the referee has given you the option. And then we would literally hound her. It's like, nope, you've taken too long. Decision. Referee says it's still the team's ball because you've taken too long. We used to plague her. She used to have everybody shouting her training, Daddy, you need to be louder. Daddy, you need to be louder. Daddy, we can't hear you. And she's gone from that. She obviously still is a quiet player, but the growth that she's made and the growth that Aoife Dalton made, especially, like, as you said, you've talked about her. She's probably one of my favourite players still to play with in both club and country, or like Leinster and country as well. Like, she's just unbelievable in what she can give you. And that's the growth that they can have in such a short spell of time. But as Lindsay said, it's about capitalising it. Strike while the iron's hot. Don't sit on it. See what else we can do in terms of growing the rest of them and others that are coming through to match it as well.
Speaking of Aoife Dalton, it's a nice segue into another centre, because Aoife Dalton has been compared quite a lot in the last couple of years
to Lynn Cantwell.
A young Lynn Cantwell. Mm-hmm. And fantastic news yesterday. Lynn Cantwell, Ireland's most capped player, Six Nations Grand Slam winner, World Cup semi-finalist, beat the Black Ferns in 2014, now head of women's strategy with the IRFU, inducted into the World Rugby Hall of Fame. I'm not sure, Lindsay, did you cross paths with her playing-wise?
No, I voice noted her yesterday.
Did she just about finish up before you were in?
She just finished up, and it was lovely but sad. I got to play with Rochelle Clark or Rocky Clark with the Barbarians, but then I'm looking at Lynn. Yeah, and I was like, so anyway, I voice noted the both of them because I said I wanted to do this personally before I put it up on social media so the world thinks we're all great friends, you know? What I said to Lynn was, I'm so jealous. One of my regrets is not coming to rugby earlier. Mm. But she was one of the inspiring players that I watched in that semi-final against England in 2014 who got me into rugby and wanting to play rugby. She buzzed off and have her family and all that, which is understandable. But she's been so brave, Lynn, to go over and take the position she did with the women box, what she's done there, just for those people alone and their story and rugby in South Africa and how much bigger it is as a sport. Like, sport does wonderful things, and that's the country of South Africa is one example of that. Mm-hmm. As a greater conduit to just keeping women especially safe and out of a lot of trouble, and then took something that was in its infancy, if not just a seed, and look to what they have done in this World Cup and what joy they've brought. And who has a full man line out?
It was absolutely
brilliant. And the gain line they made in that mall, it was brilliant. But even their short carries. But look, Lynn was a huge part of that. She went over. She had just had her third baby, over and back, and I just thought, you're so brave to do that and put yourself out there and want to be better for bigger things to come. And what better way to come back into your own nation setup and bring all that experience back and try and do that here. And she's a tough job, but no better woman for it. And I love the way she cursed profusely on the phone when she, she's not perfect after all. But look, huge congratulations to Lynn and her family and everyone involved in her. She's such a popular person, and from the few times I've met her, she's an absolute dote and so deserving of this accolade.
Yeah, I can only second that as well. I said like the same as Lindsay, I haven't had the pleasure of playing alongside her, but definitely someone who's the first kind of name that when you come into rugby kind of as a new sport, you're like, you look at her and you look at clips of what she did on the pitch and it's phenomenal. And then as Lindsay said, all that she's done for South Africa. And I think it was lovely and fitting to see them reach such heights for them as well in this competition. And as I said, the style of rugby was just class. And as I said, to have her footprint on that as where she's brought them for is just so cool. And as I said, so fitting that she's been inducted into the Hall of Fame. Like I said, I've only been at a few meetings where she's spoken, and she speaks so well. And I think she's definitely the right woman to be in the position that she is for the IRFU at the moment. So yeah, I think it's just fantastic for her and her family and everybody she's connected with. It's great.
She's actually I was thinking back now, she's the first like women's international player I'd ever heard of. Because I remember when I was in secondary school, like I'm going to say like second or third year playing rugby. She came in and did like it might have been like a conditioning session with us or something like that.
Class. Oh God, yeah, she left her mark there,
yeah,
right?
Exactly, I'll never forget it.
There's your boots.
It was like a bleep test or something.
She didn't. Neil's soul on the shelf there after.
No, I'd say maybe she didn't do a good job on the bleep test, but with me. But I just kind of always remember that name. And then by the kind of like the late 2000s and you start seeing the team more and more, and obviously those results were getting better and better. You're going, oh God, there's that name again. But
just
to throw that story in.
Yeah, like, look, anyone who meets Lynn, like, she's like a smiling assassin. But she'll definitely get you in some way. And then obviously she was in London for a long time at Richmond and plied her trade over there and was heavily involved. And, you know, any of the Irish girls who first went over to England, you know, would always speak of their meeting with Lynn. You know, and that's the typically Irish way, isn't it? Just that we put an arm around and make sure you go for a point and that you're looked after and stuff like that. And we played one of the test matches with Barbarians against South Africa, and we got to see Lynn. Lovely. It was lovely to have that piece of home over there or something. It was weird, but they're such a lovely nation and they just absolutely bleed for their rugby. And I suppose Lynn was that essentially as well. They were coupled well.
You can see, like, even when I've only been at meetings with her, where she's kind of in her new role talking at IRFU kind of gigs, and even then, like, you can see, God, you'd be like, you know that she would have just been a brilliant speaker on the pitch, like off the pitch, just the way she speaks. It's kind of that thing of when she speaks, everyone listens. And I don't think I've yet to, like, you're probably saying, you wouldn't meet anyone who has a bad word to say about her in terms of how high regard she's held by past players and current players. Is amazing. So it's great.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about her over the next few years in her role as head of women's strategy. Before we finish up, guys, quick little word on the semi-finals this weekend. So we've New Zealand against Canada Friday evening and then England-France on Saturday. New Zealand-Canada, probably the more interesting of the two games. I don't know, did you see earlier on, just before we kind of started recording here, Georgia Miller is
out. She's out, I saw that.
That is potentially game-changing.
I think that's huge.
Is it advantage Canada now?
There's something in my waters are telling me Canada are the dark horse. Like, they've had such a year. It's the first time they beat New Zealand in a pack four anyway. I think they're unbeaten this year in any test game prior coming into the World Cup.
Yeah,
I think they were 5-1 at one draw or 6-1 by the time they've finished up with us. So they've had an absolute breakout season. Georgia Miller is, like, honestly, she's like an enigma. She walks on water. Her footwork is absolutely bamboozling. I think I was cross-eyed at one stage looking at her footwork. Like, it was like, we were like, what's wrong with Lindsay's face? So I do think she's a big loss from a personality. But look, this is the Black Ferns. I think they've been growing nicely. But they're not
what they were.
No, I
everyone
think
is saying that about them. There's something missing, and I even heard people like Kiwis who were like, the front row, not what they were. Yeah. They're still able to get the job done, and they look pretty emphatic when they get it going. But they're not as kind of a force.
They're not as ruthless, have been.
No, there's something missing.
Even Porsche is giving off the ball. I'm like, that's unusual.
And even world rankings aside, like coming into the tournament, it did feel very much like the narrative was Canada were a better team than New Zealand coming into it. I think that narrative maybe changed a little bit as the tournament has moved on.
Yeah, but a little bit. I suppose how a big injury
changes things.
I do agree with Lindsay, though. I think Canada are the dark horse. I think they have, when you look at them, their style of play. Yes, they obviously had Scotland. They didn't beat them out the park, but the scores that they score, there's a lovely variety to their play, unpredictability to it. They all seem to have the savvies and the smarts, the right decision making, playing on the front foot. They seem to do that really well. So I think if they can get it going, I'd fancy Canada, but likewise, I think New Zealand, we spoke about it before coming on air, that New Zealand have the ability, we've been there, done that the last two times in a row. We can flick a switch and
They're mentally not phased, are they? Yeah. They're just like, they just kind of laugh and then like absolutely shred you to pieces at the same time. You're like, okay, cool.
Yeah, so there's that ability too. So I think that is going to be the one to watch at the weekend. They should hope, the other one, I don't think it's going to be as much of a watch, but that one is the one to watch.
Which of the two is best placed to have a crack off England in a final?
I do think, that's a hard one. See, there's something different about Canada. I know Kevin Rouet, the coach, is of French origin, and he, even after the quarterfinal win, was really annoyed at the chances they made and should have came, after the first half, saying, basically we left a lot of tries behind. So I think there's a ruthlessness and a drive about them that we probably haven't seen before. They have that physicality in that play. I think mentally, though, if you were looking at the match of physicality-wise and tactical-wise, I think Canada are okay. But the fact that New Zealand have a row of numbers on their left arm of their jersey, I think mentally and not being phased, New Zealand are probably in a better position to beat England, because I think pressure, what's going to beat England, if anything, is the pressure of delivering 100%. A home. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that even in little interviews, isn't it? With Mitchell,
they're trying very hard as well to be cool. But we spoke about it a little bit before that. The problem is when people play England, no one can do it for long enough. No one can put the pressure on for long enough. Mm. So Ireland did it for 40 minutes down in Cork. Wonderful. But then ultimately it's like floodgates open and then they just go back to what they're doing. You saw USA do it for maybe 10, 12 minutes in the opening game. Mm-hmm. Then Australia. Floodgates open. Australia, the same idea. Everyone can do it for a little bit. It's who can do it and rattle them. Because when it happens, you do see them look at each other, get a little bit angsty with each other because they're not used to it. Yeah. So they don't have anybody do that to them on a regular basis in matches throughout the year. So yeah, I do think it's who can rattle them. But as Lindsay said, New Zealand have nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. Not there, yes, they are the reigning champs, but they've been there, done that. It's your home World Cup. Yeah. You have to go and do it.
England still can't play against a team who are off the cuff.
Yeah,
I've watched their stats, and as much as he's wanted to bring in a very different style of play that would have lost them the game in 2022, they do want to offload. They do want to keep the ball alive. Muir and Botterman actually play so well together, and once they get soft shoulders and a bit of a drive, they'll offload the ball. But they still rely on set piece. They still rely on their maul. A lot of their scores are off that. And yes, on turnovers and a bit more kicking, they've been lucky. But predominantly, if people can keep it tight, really frustrate them and try and put them to their B or C game, I think, they're not infallible. They're not infallible. And I think Mitchell, with some of his, he keeps going on about... cynical play by USA after the first game.
Scotland
at the weekend. I was like, what are you expecting here, sweetheart? People are going to do whatever they need to
Absolutely.
Beat you.
It doesn't matter how it looks.
They can't match you in their depth or their player base or how skillful their players are. So they have to do something. They're respecting you, not in a purely rugby way, but you have to come up with that. And there's a frustration there with them. And they haven't reached the heights yet. And look, maybe they will in the final.
And it's a fascinating, dynamic where, from their point of view, it is either you win the World Cup or you failed.
Yeah, same as
terrible.
There's no context. We're here
before where we sat here and go, you'd love to see them win it for the sake of rugby. I was like,
those claws were out anyway.
I can't say that.
I know. Yeah. I know. Stop looking at me. Stop looking into my soul. Yeah, I'm hoping the winner comes from that semi final, I beg your pardon, on Friday night.
But ultimately, just to quickly talk about England, France, I get the impression you don't see France as being the team that,
well, not
that
now.
Can trouble them for 80 minutes with
they'll sink their two teeth players into suspended. It, ultimately.
I was going to say Dracula's
Hannah's
out.
Has been sitting on that one for about 50 minutes.
Make sure we clip that one down. I've been waiting. I wrote that down
I
in my notes.
I thought she had a cushion. Why is she told all?
Yeah, and Feleu is obviously a big loss as co-captain.
And line out wise.
What did you think of that suspension, out of curiosity? I thought a yellow card in the moment probably was fine.
Yeah, to be honest, I was surprised.
I didn't notice it as much at
Neither
the time.
Because
I was probably so focused on trying to like think of the next one, where we're going to get that score from. But I think an interesting one, I don't know, maybe does the other event make them kind of hammer down on the two of them in terms of making sure they
take over. That's what I was wondering. I was like, oh my God, they're using her as a distraction tactic. Look at this tackle over here. Yeah.
Very quickly, cards on the table. Who's going to be playing in the World Cup final?
I'm going to go Canada and England.
Yeah, I'm literally the same. I think Canada are the ones to... We'll say that now and New Zealand probably come out and look absolutely unbelievable on Friday night. But yeah, Canada.
Well, look, at least if we're their motivation, we can take credit for both. That's good, isn't it? It's a win-win for us.
All right, they're the World Cup semi-finals. New Zealand and Canada, Friday night. That is live on RT2 and RT Player. Kick-off in that game is at 7 p.m. at Ashton Gate in Bristol. Lindsay and Hannah, thanks a million for coming into the podcast studio this week to talk to us. We'll be back with another RT Rugby podcast this day next week. We'll speak to you again soon.